So I know y'all are expecting the theme music. And you're going to get the theme music in a minute. But we had to tell you something very important. This episode of Linoleum Knife is brought to you by Ovid.tv. O-V-I-D.tv. Now, you're thinking, hey, why an ad before my podcast? Well, normally we put the ad in the podcast, all conversational. But we're idiots.
We got most of the way through this episode. And we're like, wait,
we're supposed to be doing an ad. And now it's too late. So you can't turn off this podcast if you want to hear the ad for Ovid TV. And here's the thing. You want this.
Yes.
It's an app that we love.
You need it in your life.
We're only doing this ad because we dig Ovid.
Yeah.
They have many, many different of our favorite independent film distributors on their app. And you can watch all kinds of really cool stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Art house for serious art house people.
Oh, yeah.
You know, Criterion Channel's great.
Absolutely.
All.
But this is...
You're going to get like Kim Stim and Grasshopper and...
Women Make Movies.
Monument and all these, you know, other places.
Icarus.
Yeah. The little people.
Yeah.
The little people doing big, wonderful things.
Exactly.
Like, okay, so this week there's a film on Ovid called The Substance. It's a documentary from 2011.
Yes.
That's the thing. You get these 2011 documentaries and they make a blip and then they go away. And then your friends are like, did you ever see this documentary from 2011 called The Substance? And everyone says, no. Now you can.
Now you can. Exactly.
The Substance is about the invention of LSD.
I know.
And you know all about LSD, Alonzo.
Oh, do we have to go here again?
You were a super drug taker in college.
I was not a super anything.
You and all your drug-taking friends in college, you took LSD.
I dabbled at best.
I, always terrified of drugs.
You were a clean teen.
Never took a darn thing.
And we both found The Substance fascinating.
And listen, I love drugs as a subject.
Sure.
I wouldn't watch Valley of the Dolls over and over again if I didn't.
It's a vicarious thing for you.
Yeah. But, you know, watching this with a person who has actually used LSD many times while an undergraduate and slacking throughout his classes, like my husband.
Behave.
Made it like a 4D experience. there's this other great movie on that I think it drops this month, called My Revolution. Set in Paris during the Arab Spring, about a Tunisian boy. He's 14 years old, and he meets a girl. And he wants to impress her, and he's not political at all. He doesn't care about the Arab Spring. He winds up at a protest and, you know, gets his face on TV, and all the kids at school think he's great and think he's cool. And all he really cares about is like impressing this girl. It's kind of like if A Little Romance was set during, you know,
a political,
you know, demonstration.
Yeah. There's footnotes, which is really cool. You know, look, any movie that says that it's inspired by Jacques Demy and Stanley Donen, sign me up.
Yeah.
Christophe Honoré's Metamorphoses.
Footnotes is a musical comedy about a woman who works in a factory in France. So it's original songs and dancing.
Yeah.
And you're a big musical fan.
It is true. So yeah, Ovid has all kinds of amazing stuff. Great foreign films, great docs, great American indies.
And if you're like, I haven't heard of any of these movies you just talked about, well, that's the point.
Exactly. Yeah, just because you haven't heard of them doesn't mean they aren't great. It just means they are...
You haven't seen them yet, that's all.
It means that the way that, you know, theatrical and video distribution in this country is, it's really hard to get cool, small, interesting titles to a wide audience. But that's what's so awesome about the streaming revolution in general, and Ovid.tv in specific.
There's a special offer for all of you listeners of Linoleum Knife. 50% off the first 3 months of your subscription. You go to Ovid.tv. That is www.ovid.
No, www. Dot.
Yes.
Grandpa.
You know what I mean. www. And then that little dot. And then OVID. And then another little dot. TV. You sign up with the coupon code PODCAST, the word podcast.
Yes.
You'll get Ovid.tv for $3.50 per month for three entire months. The offer expires October 25th.
Get on it.
Do it. And now you're going to hear the theme song of Linoleum Knife, and we're going to start talking about the current cinema.
Enjoy. A podcast of the cinema.
Starring me, my name is Dave White. I'm a film critic for The Wrap.
Yes.
You're my sidekick. Of somewhat lesser importance.
Please.
Your name is Alonzo Duralde. You're the reviews editor of The Wrap, also a film critic for The Wrap, also the co-host of Who Shot Ya on the Maximum Fun Network, also the co-host of Breakfast All Day on the Breakfast All Day Network, and...
Dig me, I'm giving out wings.
And my aunt... Does he say dig me?
Isn't it?
I don't think... Did people say dig me back in 1946?
Well, you know, if you were a jazz bow.
Maybe he said check me. Oh, check me. I don't know what he said.
I'll have to look now.
Come December when we go see it again for the 7,000th time.
Yes.
We'll get that line right.
Okay.
You're also my legally wedded spouse.
Yes.
We're the film critic married people.
We are. That's us.
I still think there might not be any others.
That are like professionals now.
Right.
I mean, I bet there are married couples who have
of course there are married couples that have podcasts, and there are probably married couples that have film podcasts.
That's what I'm saying.
Here's the thing. You were talking about something entirely other than what I was thinking about.
Okay.
And that awkward silence was, are we allowed to discuss this in public, this other thing? But
I have no idea what you're talking about. Well, you can tell me when we're off.
Okay. I'll leave it there.
I don't want to know.
No one's in trouble.
Good.
Everything's okay.
Phew. It's terrible when people are in trouble.
I you know what I hate?
Tell me.
The Grove, when I have to walk through it. I just had, like, one of the best experiences, and then also one of the worst experiences.
Mm-hmm. The Grove, I think, is an outgrowth of Hollywood Boulevard in terms of...
Oh, it sure is.
There are people who come to Los Angeles and assume that it's all a theme park.
They've done a bang-up job of marketing the Grove as a tourist destination.
Yes. So they walk around as though they were in a theme park, which means as though no one behind them were heading anywhere in a rush.
No.
Or had a
Not
place
one,
to be.
Nowhere to
so
be.
So they can just like...
Cheesecake Factory will always be there.
Yeah.
And it will stay open.
They can just spread out and stop suddenly and take pictures and have their double-wide strollers. And it's like, whatever.
The Grove is an open-air shopping mall in Los Angeles.
Yes.
And it is right next to CBS Television City in Hollywood.
Mm-hmm. Some days you go and everybody's got their little Prices Right tags on.
I was fixing to say, there were lots of Prices Right t-shirt people walking around, which made me confused.
I guess they tape on Sundays.
What are they doing taping on a Sunday? Who does that?
Drew does, I guess.
I don't get it. You know those union people are like, you're going to me do what on a Sunday?
Yeah. Double time? Sure. No problem.
There were Prices Right people walking around. Weirdly enough, there was also Nestor Carbonell, the actor.
Uh-huh.
He was on Lost, and he was on The Tick.
The Tick,
he was on
Batman Well.
Yeah.
And he actually
I saw him with his family.
He's Batman well, but he's also like the mayor of Gotham or something in The Dark Knight.
Oh, yeah. All right. And then Tig Notaro was there with one of her kids. And so I was like, hey, you're well known. Oh, you're less well known. But like
just another Sunday in Los Angeles.
Yeah. Anyway, that's not here nor there. But the best part of it was the first part where I got to go to the Grove Movie Theater and be alone.
I remember that joke where they were like, when he was still alive, they said that if Osama bin Laden wanted to hide out from the authorities, he should go to a screening of Roberto Benigni's Pinocchio.
Oh, yeah. Now he should go to see The Goldfinch.
Apparently.
You warned me against it. So did everyone.
Yes.
Everyone said, no, no, no. No! Don't do it. But I did. I wanted to see that creamy Roger Deakins photography.
Sure. Fair enough.
Listen. There's a part in this movie where the kid has to go live with tacky people.
Ew.
In a bad place.
In Nevada.
In Nevada, in a subdivision with no trees, and all the buildings are that brown stucco. And all the furniture is like that composite wood that you get at Walmart. And just, you know, Costco furniture. You know, he manages to make everything look gorgeous, no matter where this film is set.
Yeah.
Thank God they don't spend too long dwelling in that location.
Did it give you any New Mexico flashbacks?
No, because I lived in New Mexico in the 1970s and early 1980s. Uh-huh. And those crappy subdivisions didn't exist yet. All the homes were those little flat roof adobe kind of houses.
Oh, gotcha. Okay.
They were all identical, just like the ones here.
Because I feel like
they had a kind of character to them.
I feel like I've driven by that cul-de-sac a bunch of times when we've been in Albuquerque.
Well, yeah, you have. But this was, as you know by the film, this was terrible. Like, this is like half the houses are empty, and there's no one there. There's nothing there. And it's just
a literal desert.
It's the desert, you know. Some people love living in the desert. Maybe they have a nice place to live in when they live in the desert. This is not it.
Yeah.
All right, backing up. So I go see the Goldfinch. And I think, well, no one here, I guess I'll just tweet. I don't know that I've ever live tweeted a movie from a theater before. But I thought to myself, this poor movie has now a distinction.
Yes.
It is in the top five or bottom five?
Worst openings.
Worst wide release openings in history.
Yes.
It opened on 2,600 screens or something like that. And on Friday, it earned like $800,000. Its total amount for the weekend. And normally, I don't care about this kind of stuff. But things like this, I pay attention to because it makes me feel sorry for the movie.
Well, I mean, do you remember when everybody was reading the book?
Yes.
There was that moment where just everybody was reading The Goldfinch.
Right.
And clearly, like,
everybody that we know. How about that?
I don't want to be like Pauline Kael talking about Nixon.
Every bougie literary person that we know.
Right. The people who read books were all reading The Goldfinch.
Right. Yeah.
And the people who read The Goldfinch apparently also read reviews.
Yeah, well,
because they did not run out to the theater.
They
did
not. No, they did not. But I did. And I thought, no one in the country is watching this movie right now except me.
Right.
Like, it's on 2,500 other movie screens, but I'm the only one watching the film right now.
Had the Grove.
It's playing to 2,500 empty houses as I write.
Had the Grove already booted it to the tiniest house?
My $19 ticket makes a difference.
Wow. 19 for a matinee?
Well, I'm sorry. It was 18, because it was $17.50 plus some kind of little taxi thing.
Lord. But have they already booted it to like house
7?
Yeah.
House 7.
Yeah.
But They had on two screens.
Ooh.
Yeah.
Ouch.
So sad.
Mm.
And the movie doesn't deserve this because it's only just bad. It's
yeah,
not.
It should be tanking as a smaller release.
It's not. It's not. It's not a bad movie for the ages.
Yeah, it's somebody out of Toronto is like, oh, it's this year's bad. The Book of Henry.
No,
and I'm like,
it's not the Book of Henry. Book of Henry is the Book of Henry
legendary.
Is wall to wall bonkers.
Yeah,
this movie is just
misguided.
There are so many things happening, and you are kind of following all of the things that happen until the last 40 minutes, where it turns into a caper. and then there's a lot of exposition.
Oh, so much.
That happens, and you think, wait, I'm sorry, who has the painting? Like, because this film is about a little kid played by...
Oakes Fegley.
His name was half blacked out on the marquee. They had a thing up above the... above the marquee, a big banner for the movie, and there was a street sign, a lamppost in my way because I was walking to the entrance, and the O was divided in half, and I thought someone in the movie was named Cakes.
Yes, Cakes Fegley.
Listen.
Important young actor.
What if someone... What if you all started naming your children Cakes?
It's a family name.
It's a family name. We're from the Baltimore Cakes. The Lady Baltimore Cakes.
There we go.
So this kid... and he is with his mother in a museum.
Yes. The Metropolitan Museum.
The Metropolitan Museum of Art in New York City. And... there's a terrorist attack.
Yes.
And there's a bombing and lots of people die. And just digression. What a smart idea to open a terrorism themed film on September 13th.
Oh yes. Well done, Warner Brothers.
How'd you figure out a release date for that one?
Oh,
like,
brother.
It's about a kid whose mother dies in a terrorist attack
in New York City.
Let's open it on the week of September
11th. Oh God.
Yeah. So
maybe that's why they didn't have any Thursday night screenings.
Maybe that's why.
Or maybe just because they knew this thing was going to not do anything.
Well, don't they test those things? Don't they track them for their releases?
I know. They trotted it out at Toronto.
Right.
But apparently, according to...
That backfired.
The reviews were terrible. And then according to somebody I know who does like the interview side of things, they were like, they didn't do a lot of
right.
press.
Yeah.
So...
Yeah. In the ensuing chaos, he is one of the few people who live.
Yes.
Through the attack, and what winds up on the floor in the rubble is a priceless 17th century painting called The Goldfinch. And a dying man. Who turns out to be connected to other people that this kid is going to encounter.
Yeah, he happens to be in a room with like every character practically who's going to matter for the rest of the movie.
The man says, take that painting. And you don't know why he tells the kid to do that, but the kid's like, okay. Like, takes the painting. Puts it in his backpack and then keeps it for years secretly. And for reasons that are never quite explained, and for purposes that do not become apparent until the film has been, until the film has reached its about hour and 45 minute mark. Yeah. And so he bounces between.
It's a metaphor, see?
Yes. He bounces between a very, very waspy patrician family in New York City. The mother, played by Nicole Kidman, perfectly.
Oh, yeah, no, she walks away from this unscathed. No
Nicole
question.
Kidman is so everything you need her to be in this movie in every single moment. from the way she looks to the hair to the outfits.
It's like being doted upon by Babe Paley.
It's like the quietest Babe Paley. Mm. The quietest. How are you feeling? Are you hungry? Would you like to summer in Maine with us? We'd love you to summer in Maine with us. In the words of good friend and neighbor Gary Cotty. Hello, I'm Nicole Kidman. I'm made of whispers and glass.
She's not always, but in certain movies.
In this movie, she is made of whispers and glass.
No question.
In Destroyer, no.
Yeah, no, exactly.
In this movie, she's doing
whispers
that thing.
And water for Listen, crystal.
This is my favorite version of Nicole Kidman.
Oh, yeah. The birth Nicole Kidman?
The most, like, serene mother.
Yes.
And then by the end, she's in full matronly Chanel with that big bulletproof Dina Merrill hair.
Mm-hmm.
It's great. Furthermore, all the scenes that she's in usually center in the family apartment. Breathtakingly beautiful apartment. The best furniture.
John Waters always says, if you're bored in a movie, look at the lamps. Ooh. This movie does give you some lamps.
This movie got the lamps. But of course, then, the kid's ne'er-do-well father shows up, played by Luke Wilson. Really well and really slimy and really awful.
Yes.
And takes the kid to Nevada.
Right.
With a version of Sarah Paulson I've never seen before.
I was going to say, whoever thought Sarah Paulson for this role is like, okay, that's outside the box, but it works.
A version of Sarah Paulson I've never seen before. Like, gum-chewing, tacky, zebra-striped hoodie, mean.
Bikini-wearing. Yeah.
And you're looking at her going, what's up with that body?
Yeah.
You have never.
Ryan Murphy did not request.
Ryan Murphy does not care about that body. But I have a feeling, like, as I saw her in that scene, I thought, she's digging this.
Oh, God, yeah.
She's digging.
She's having a blast.
She's digging being, like, the trashy sex lady.
Yes. the subliterate stay out of my cigarettes.
Because she never gets to be that character.
No, of course not.
And, you know, chain smoking and, you know, here's a can of SpaghettiOs, jerk. I know you're 9. Open it yourself. Like, it's that kind of character.
Although, really, Zandra with an X, that's gilding the plastic
it's
lily.
It's laying it on a little thick. But I didn't mind. Mm. They drag the kid off to a place with terrible furniture.
Yes.
All composite wood.
How dare they?
But you know what? He knows he doesn't belong there.
Yeah.
He's gonna do whatever it takes.
To get back to Nicole Kidman.
To get back to Nicole Kidman. That is his rightful home. Listen, if you suffer extreme trauma, if one of your parents dies in a terrorist attack and the other one runs off as an alcoholic and runs off with, like, the, I guess, whoever it was, whatever employment the lady had, then if a rich family decides to take a shine to you and says, we'd love it if you would summer in Maine with us. Hook or by crook, you get there.
Oh, totally.
You run the grift on all the richies you can get through.
However, the other...
You climb that ladder.
The other best part of this movie, apart from any moment where Nicole Kidman is on screen, is the friendship that he has with Finn Wolfhard in Nevada.
Who's doing a kind of hilarious Russian accent.
Yes.
And who I did feel...
Of the Boris and Natasha school.
Deep empathy for that one in the early one of the early scenes of their meeting, the kid's like, I hate sun. Pops that big big black umbrella open, and the kid and the Goldfinch kid's like, and little Goldfinch, whatever his name is, little Goldfinch says, what's that for? And the kid said, I tell you, I hate sun. Walks around with the umbrella. I've done that.
No, I know.
I took an umbrella to Disneyland once. I was like, no, I don't care. I know it's not goth day. I don't care. I hate the sun beating down on me all day.
Your parasol.
Took an umbrella there. Ain't nobody said boo to me either when I did it.
Who would dare?
No, yeah, indeed. So the so this movie is so full of stuff and so not full of explanation.
Yeah, like it is overlong and not long enough at the same time.
Who was Pippa and why was Pippa? Like, he writes letters to her. He's clearly in love with her.
We are told that she is the love of his life, and we have no idea why.
I don't even know whose daughter she is in the film. Like, she's being cared for by the antiques guys, but like...
I thought she was related to the guy who dies in the explosion. Is she not?
Is she? Is that her father?
I thought maybe her grandfather.
But he's the antiques guy. And right. They're clearly a gay couple.
Yeah, but you know.
Or I thought they were, anyway.
We know old gays with children.
I suppose. They never make any connection as to who this little child, like, to whom do you belong?
The whole time I kept thinking, you must have really mattered in the book.
Oh, yeah, yeah,
because
yeah.
I'm watching you now and I have no idea why you're here.
Yeah. About every 15 minutes I thought to myself, I don't understand why any of this is happening. But Roger Deakins.
Well, yes.
Roger Deakins... You're not listening.
You could give him a hotels.com ad.
You're the top of the class. You're the top of your game. Like anything. There's a scene when little Goldfinch grows up and become big Goldfinch.
Oh, and it gets much less interesting when he turns into Ansel Elgort.
And little Russian kid grows up to be big Russian crime friend.
Yes.
There's a scene with her in a bar talking together, and they are just so perfectly composed, and these little crappy lamps above their heads are shining down on them like this angelic glow. And I thought, how long did it take to light that scene? Because it's gorgeous. And it just goes by like that. That's just like that's just the kind of stuff he would do in his sleep. Like, oh, this is a scene that barely matters. Well, I'm gonna make it matter. It's going to make them seem so innocent and so destined to be a couple.
There is,
you kind of think that the Russian kid is in love with him, but you don't really.
They have more chemistry than most of the people in the movie.
They touch. They kiss goodbye at one point as kids.
Yeah, like kisses them on the mouth.
Yeah, on the mouth. But it's not. There's no.
It's never mentioned or
never mentioned again. Yeah.
Yeah.
Jeffrey Wright clearly attended some Nicole Kidman tutorial sessions.
Yeah, well.
Because listen, there are certain movies
you go on YouTube and you take the Nicole Kidman masterclass.
He is doing the rasp, and this is one of those
Anna
movies.
Anna Wintour's got the masterclass now where she teaches you how to be the devil who wears Prada, I guess. And
how to berate assistants.
Nicole Kidman needs to teach a masterclass in how to be more like Nicole Kidman. I can't say that I hated this movie.
Oh, I can.
I'm glad I watched it. I'm glad I was there. I'm glad I got to tweet about it to people.
Well, yeah, no. If I'd sat in a theater by myself and got the tweet during it, I might have enjoyed it more. it was one of those movies where I thought, you know what? I am allowed to go to get popcorn midway through if I feel like it. And I did. Without worrying that I was going to miss anything important, because nothing important happens ever.
In some way, you're right, you know. I don't know.
It's just...
I want there to be beautiful, sort of, you know, ordinary people style, preppy-ass movies like this.
We've talked about this before when, like, we were in 8th or 9th grade and we got to start seeing, like, quote-unquote adult movies and we felt so very sophisticated.
Yeah.
Like, as a 12-year-old, I would think, oh, yes, I'm seeing the important, I'm going to see the Goldfinch this weekend.
Yes.
You know, but it's,
that's the other thing.
And then you get older and like, oh, wait, this movie is nonsense that means nothing.
That's the other thing. The children in this film.
Yes.
The children
and
in
their
this film
opinions.
All have super sophisticated adult opinions about classical music, Glenn Gould, their favorite art in the Met, literature.
Didn't buy any of it for a second. Like, will one of you please eat a hot dog? Listen to New Kids on the Block.
Listen,
come on.
I'm down. That's catnip for me. You get like like wildly inappropriately sophisticated kids in a movie discussing really highbrow stuff with each other or with adults. It doesn't matter. And the adults are like, tell me more about your research on this matter.
You can do it right. Like A Little Romance, I think, is a movie that gets away with that.
Right.
But not this one. Not this one, Dave.
Ansel Elgort, who, in the words of one of my friends, but I agree with this entirely, has perhaps cinema's most punchable face.
Yes, yes. That is a dead-on accurate observation. And if the Goldfinch doesn't make you want to punch his face, go watch his music video, Thief, on YouTube. It's hilarious.
I did not despise his performance or carriage through this film.
How generous of you.
I'm feeling a little generous toward this movie because I think it's getting dumped on in a way that it might not fully deserve, at least in terms of, all the other mediocre trash that's out there. This is an aspirational bad movie.
But it's from people who should know better. Like, it's directed by the guy who did Brooklyn.
I think he tried.
One of the adapters of Tinker Tailor Soldier Spy, which is another difficult novel to bring to the screen, and he did.
Right.
And this one is not that.
So, you don't have much time.
Yeah, I was saying, it's leaving theaters as we speak.
You don't have much time to see the Goldfinch. It opened on Friday. It may be out of theaters by Tuesday.
Yeah.
They may just dump all their
screens. Pretend it never happened.
It's going to wind up on an abbreviated schedule at the Dollar Theater and then leave that in a week. So, go to the theater where it's playing that has the comfiest seats because it is 2.5 hours long.
Mm-hmm.
And enjoy all the Brooks Brothers. Enjoy all the sofas.
This is a good Coates movie.
Oh yeah,
a lot of good Coates.
This is definitely for a colder weather.
Yeah,
you get to see people in there's a lot of tweed. There's a shootout with some tweed.
Yes, good, but like it's a really really good trenches.
Yeah,
yeah, but it's not. Yeah, but you're right. It's not like bananas bad.
No,
it's
not
just
at all.
It's just dull and up its own ass.
Yeah.
But impeccably bespoke.
So there I have this beautifully peaceful time in this film, and then I have to go into the farmer's market next to the Grove and buy ingredients for tonight's dinner. And
yes,
everyone was in my way. And it's a hot day in Los Angeles. I'm sweaty and cranky. I just come from peace and quiet
and solitude
and solitude and then like people. Another thing I didn't anticipate when I decided I'm just going to start tweeting this movie. I wound up getting like 2-3 dozen new followers out of it.
I was amplifying you.
Well, don't do that anymore.
No, people need to know.
It's not that I dislike new followers. It's just I feel a lot of stress. I feel the pressure.
Relax.
Like, if any of you are listening to this podcast for the first time because you started following me on Twitter because you found me, I can only disappoint you. So, like, don't expect a lot. That's all.
You tweet infrequently, but always, incisively. No, the farmer's market is a weird setup because, like, you've got, on the one hand, it's a place where people might actually go to purchase things like a butcher shop and whatever. But on the other hand, it's like got, sticker stores and goofy tourism things.
Lots of stickers with my name.
Yeah. None with mine.
None with yours.
You've got all the keychains.
Oh.
All the souvenir license plates.
Hey, why don't you talk about that new Molly Ivins documentary?
Ooh, yes, I would be happy to. Raise Hell, The Life and Times of Molly Ivins. I originally reviewed it out of Sundance. It opened a couple weeks ago in Texas, and then last week in New York, and now it's finally in Los Angeles. And it is a documentary about Molly Ivins, who, if you are not familiar
Explain
with her
who
work,
she was.
I'm going to do that.
Do it now.
She was. Don't delay. I'm going to step on your foot. She was a Texas-based pundit and wrote in a very funny and incisive way
about... She had a newspaper column.
Yes. Magazine columnist, newspaper columnist.
Yes.
She had a, yeah.
She was in print when it meant something.
She was in print when people were still in print. And was, you know, she was a tall lady, and she was funny, and she, you know, she stood out in a lot of ways, and she really spoke truth to power in a way that a lot of Texas journalists did not at that time, and became rather well known for her colorful descriptions of the Texas legislature and everything it was doing wrong.
Right.
She wrote several books. She, because she was in Texas, she had a front row seat for the ascension of George W. Bush.
Mm-hmm.
Wrote the book Shrub.
Yep.
She gave him that name. And yeah, so she is just generally speaking like a funny and vital American woman of letters, sort of getting her due in this documentary. And you know, it's about her personal life and her personal problems. She had a lot of issues with drinking. She eventually died of cancer.
Yeah.
You know, it talks about her disappointment with politicians that she believed in and then that let her down, most specifically Bill Clinton and his welfare reform.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, they talk to people who knew her, like, you know, Cecile Richards and Dan Rather, and also people who were inspired by her, like Rachel Maddow, and her own, like, you know, sort of personal friends and coworkers. And it's just this really kind of fascinating life story of a fascinating life. And while it is mostly kind of a talking heads doc, like, the quotes from Molly are really funny.
They're perfect.
You know,
she was perfect.
She had, she was not only a funny writer, but she had great delivery. So you would see her on like C-SPAN or giving a speech at some awards thing. And she just, her timing, her facial expressions, it's all very, very funny. And, you know, like she was very, very, you know, progressive. And, you know, the stuff that she had to say and the stuff that she called out remains very vital and of the moment. And so, yeah, this is a movie that, you know, if the world feels hopeless of late, as it often does, you know, it's a reminder there are people out there who know what to say about it and know how to, like, you know, focus their anger and their suspicion and their, you know, inquiry about the world and how it works.
You just said everything I wanted to say.
Okay.
I loved this movie and I loved her. She was part of my political education.
Same here.
When I lived in Texas for almost 20 years. And
I was there on and off for about a decade.
As a young man, you know, reading her, paying attention to her, and understanding that you could hate things and be fun at the same time.
Right.
And she hated all the right things.
Yes.
She hated all the bad people doing bad things. She hated all the people who were trying to make life impossible for other people.
Yeah.
Republicans. And she did so in a way that made them almost unable to find their bearings enough to attack back.
Right. Because, you know, she knew what she was talking about, so they couldn't call her out for, like, not having her facts right.
Right.
And she was funny about it, so it was hard to respond to it without seeming like a spoil sport.
Right. I love my favorite quote in the movie, I think, is also in the trailer, where she said, "There are some people who, you know, use humor in a way to make us all feel like we're connected, like Garrison Keillor." Back in the 1980s, Garrison Keillor was very popular. The Prairie Home Companion was very popular. She said, "And then there are people like me who use humor to hold up the powerful to ridicule and contempt." and that just makes me feel warm all over. She were alive today,
oh,
she
man.
Should be.
Yeah.
Joe Biden would call her divisive.
Ugh. Yeah, well.
As would every milky liberal.
Centrist Democrat, you know. No, thank you.
The I just all the thoughts just left my head. I'm very sorry about that. That was dead air. It wasn't even intentional dead air.
Like sometimes your usual gaps.
Sometimes I love to make intentional dead air.
But Harold Pinter over here.
That was not one of those times.
Do you talk about the big movie of the weekend?
Not yet. Okay. I saw Brittany Runs a Marathon.
Okay.
While you were gone,
which went wider this weekend, I believe.
Oh, did it?
Yeah.
Well,
that's why we've been seeing a whole new wave of Jillian Bell on TV shows.
Oh, that makes sense.
Yeah.
She was just on the Kelly Clarkson show.
Yes.
with Chance the Rapper telling him that he was in her playlist. And he said, I'm your biggest fan. You have no idea. And she's like, I'm shocked that you even know who I am. He said, no. We even have mutual friends, and I've been trying to get them to introduce you to me. And then she's like, well, you're in my playlist. And she goes, and so is Pitbull. And he spit out his drink. Because you know, if you're Chance the Rapper, you don't want people to say, I love you and Pitbull. Like, that's...
That was like, yeah.
Although, come on, who doesn't like Pitbull?
Orson Welles used to talk about how, like, you know, the French would say...
It's uncool to like Pitbull. But who doesn't really love Pitbull?
Orson Welles would say, like, the French would say, oh, you're one of the three great directors. And he goes, and then I'd make the mistake of asking who the other two were, and it would always be, like, Dreyer and Nicholas Ray. No shade on Nicholas Ray, but, you know, if you're Orson Welles, I mean, come on.
In a lonely place. Get out of here. This is Gillian Bell's film. It was written and directed by Paul Downs Colaizzo. I don't really know him. I'm clicking through IMDb to see if I should know him. His second film, LFE, which I did not see, did not know existed. Anyway, Gillian Bell plays a young woman named Brittany. And if you watch the trailer for this film and you look at the poster, which shows her grimacing while holding a pair of sneakers in one hand and a glass of wine, am I right, in the other hand, it'll make you not want to see the movie.
Everything has turned me off to this movie.
Yeah.
I know you and other people have been telling me that what I'm seeing is not what I'm getting, but
the trailer is not fully indicative of what you get. The first 15 minutes, though, were a little touch and go for me, because you see all the things that she's doing wrong in her life. She's partying too much. She's drinking too much. She's eating the wrong things. And they really focus on, like, showing you, oh, look at that giant cheeseburger she's got in her mouth. And I'm like, shut up, movie.
And give me a cheeseburger.
You know, she's trying to fit into a pair of, like, something or other, and you see, like, a normal person's amount of fat wads, you know, coming out of it, like a roll, you know. And I think there are just enough fat-hating people in the world that they would watch those scenes and go, ew, she's got to change everything, you know.
Her life's not working.
I was worried about that during the first 15, because I thought, do not lay all her problems, you know, at the feet of her barely fat body.
Right.
Right. She's, how fat is she? Kinda.
She is not thin.
And she's not really fat.
Right.
She's in the middle. She's movie fat.
Oh,
right?
Well then.
She has a normal body for...
She's Amy Schumer.
Yeah. You want to see fat, you come out of this house.
I'll show you some fat.
I'll just slap my belly just there. I'll tell you, I'll show you some fat. Anyway, she decides she's going to start exercising because the doctor tells her that if she wants to fix, you know, high blood pressure and, you know, pre-diabetes and her insomnia... Not her insomnia. She sleeps too much, actually.
Yeah.
You know, her exhaustion, that kind of stuff. That she needs to exercise and, in his words, maybe lose 45, 55 pounds. And she's like,
yeah.
GTFO. And, but she begins and she finds herself in the company of other local exercising people, Michaela Watkins, as a cranky neighbor who seems at first to have her whole life together, and then bit by bit you understand that, no, her life is actually sort of in a crumbling state. And then a gay guy played by Micah Stock, who is a person I had not noticed before in anything, but apparently he's been on Broadway, and I think he was nominated for a Tony for something.
Oh, okay.
So he's like this gay guy who's out trying to run. Mm-hmm. And he has, you know, bad self-esteem and all this kind of stuff. And so, although he has a great life, because they eventually go to his apartment. He's got this, like, handsome husband and a little kid, you know, and they've got money, you know. The film is really just about how these three people sort of come together. And it does not skimp on the darker side of what happens to you when you don't like your body and when you project that onto other people.
Mm-hmm.
Or when your body begins to change and then you see other people who used to look like you, who look like you used to, and then you project your sort of newfound superiority onto other people. She's not a heroine every moment of this film. She's unpleasant through a chunk of this movie. And in the end, it's actually quite moving. Not in a personal triumph, inspiration, you know, you can do it, you go girl kind of way, but in this human connection kind of way where people are learning about each other's frailty and understanding it and developing empathy for each other.
How does it compare to the Patty Duke TV movie Before and After, which we watched not long ago for LKTV?
Well, I'll tell you. In the Patty Duke television movie Before and After, which takes place in the late 1970s, during the jogging
craze.
The jogging craze. The jogging craze of the 1970s. Google it. It was a thing.
Jim Fix.
It happened. There's a song that was written specifically, a disco song. I need to be very specific. A disco song written for the film.
By Gimble and Fox.
Called Hot Now, yes. As in, you were gross, but you're hot now. So what I was afraid of in the first 15 minutes, all the fat, shamey kind of stuff, it's there in ways that I think are fairly undeniable, and I don't like it still.
Mm-hmm.
But it becomes something else.
Hmm.
And it is, in many ways, the perfect cinematic rebuke to pukey garbage people like Bill Maher, who insist on making sure that they know that they actually do hate fat people.
Right.
Which is fine by me, because I never wanted to be his friend anyway.
Indeed. By the way, our listener Karen has had a very interesting take, I think, on the James Corden response to Bill Maher that everyone's having, you know,
I don't know what James Corden's response is.
James Corden did a response to Bill Maher that basically calling him out for fat shaming and saying that it was stupid. But at one point in it, kind of does this thing of like, well, we're all trying to lose weight. We'd like to be thinner. You know, we know that it's not good for us, but still, be nice. And it's sort of like, do we have have the caveat?
Shut up, James Corden.
Like, people's bodies are different, and some people just are that way. And
I do what
like,
I want.
Yeah, exactly. Like, you know, it's bad enough when the anti-fat bully people try and masquerade their bullying as concern.
You cannot be fat in the world without the advice of others.
Oh God!
No. Without the looks of others.
Yes.
Without the, when you leave the room, concern from others.
Sure. But we don't have to do it to ourselves.
Oh yeah, no. That is correct. And I don't need James Corden speaking for me
on anything.
On anything, I'm plenty happy to do that all by myself. Jillian Bell actually on the Kelly Clarkson show later in the interview said the following. She said, I have been many different sizes in my life. And Kelly Clarkson said, me too. I've got three sizes of everything in the back right now.
Yeah.
My stylist makes three different sizes of everything for me. And she said, I had a different body 5 years ago. I had a different body from that 10 years ago. I've got a different body now. now that I've made this movie because I lost 45 pounds making this movie. She said, none of those bodies were good or bad. They just were my body.
Right.
And my health and my life are not about how that body looked.
Yeah.
And I think that's exactly what we need to understand about this sort of thing. That you are fat, you are skinny, you want to be less fat, you want to be less skinny, you want to be more skinny, you want to be more, you want to weigh more than you are because you are self-conscious about being skinny. I've known people in my life who are so skinny, it's hard for them to gain weight.
Oh, yeah.
They do everything they can to put on weight.
Yeah.
Because bodies are different.
Yes.
And so, but the thing that everyone should remember is that if you are healthy, if you are in good health, and you are happy with how you look, then that is everything you need to be.
If your heart and your lungs and your knees are fine with whatever you are at, then love the skin you're in.
Also, you go, girl.
With your glass of wine.
With your glass of wine. You guys, wine. I wonder if she was put up to that photo. And like, here I am with my wine. Oh, my goodness. Look at me. I'm a sloppy mess.
I would like to think so. That was not her idea.
Yeah. Hustlers.
Yes.
Hustlers. Hustlers. It's a nice tea song.
it's been a weird weekend. Like, especially on film Twitter.
Yeah.
Like, people are going bananas about this movie.
Yes.
And it's good.
I would say it's pretty good.
It's pretty good.
It's a pretty good movie.
But can we maybe not, like, dance in the streets?
How about you talk about it before you opinionate?
You're right. You're right. Okay. So, based on a New York Magazine article about a scam that was run by women who were strippers at Scores.
A very good scam.
Yes.
One that I fully support in the Robin Hood school.
Right. Well,
of scams.
Good thing, because the movie does too.
Yeah.
So it stars Constance Wu as a woman who's been an exotic dancer for a while. She gets a new job at Moves, which is this movie's fake Scores.
Right.
And she's the new girl. But the queen of the roost is Ramona, played by Jennifer Lopez, who very quickly takes Constance Wu's character, Destiny, under her wing.
Right.
And, you know, it's the mid-2000s. It's 2007, 2008, and everything's great, and everything's flush, and there's so much money, and it's so exciting, and everything is awesome. And then 2008 happens, and the bottom falls out of the housing market, and suddenly the Wall Street guys with their bottomless expense accounts are no longer anywhere to be found, and, you know, it's just not the same anymore, and
they're
all struggling. And Destiny leaves to, like, have a baby, and then she's in financial trouble and crosses paths with Ramona again, finds out that Ramona has a new thing going on, which is she and a couple of the other strippers will meet a guy, they'll like find their pigeon.
They basically go freelance.
They go freelance.
Yeah.
They'll go to some like swanky oak-lined New York bar. They'll find the guy who's got the expensive shoes and the gold watch. They'll you know, start chatting him up, maybe slip a little something in his drink.
They drug these guys.
They drug these guys, drag him to the strip club, drain their credit cards, throw him in a taxi cab.
And leave. Yeah.
And the next day, if the guy calls to complain about it, they're like, what? You had a great time.
You just were partying don't remember hard it. And you spent a lot of money. And
yeah. And do you really want to like make a big deal about this and, you know, have to tell your wife why you had $15,000 on your credit card at a strip club?
Yeah.
And, you know, and it works. And it works so well that, in fact, not only does Destiny get on board, but they have to start expanding out to other girls. And some of the other girls aren't as reliable. And that's when, of course, it all falls apart.
Yeah.
But the movie does not have one tear to shed for these creepy Wall Street guys who...
And never judges the women for doing what they
did. No. This is a strip club movie that is very female gaze, both in terms of its attitude about the women that work there and the presentation of what they do there. But it's very, you know, you know, it sets up a world in which men are the exploiters, and so men should be exploited.
Men are the exploiters and the criminals.
Yeah.
Who have caused the financial crisis that ruined the financial lives of every working class person.
Exactly.
It is made very explicitly pointed that the women in this club are those people who have lost their jobs.
Yeah.
And whose
careers have suffered. These guys destroyed the economy. Yeah. Nobody went to jail.
Jennifer Lopez has no fewer than two speeches in the film about the moral correctness of what they are doing.
Yes.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, like the... And it's almost... And the movie, like, there's nobody in the character... There's no character in the movie who ever sort of says, maybe we shouldn't do this as much as... Maybe we're going to get caught if we're sloppy about this,
right?
You know, which is a refreshing attitude, I think.
They do feel a moment of empathy for one of their men,
yes,
who it turns out is not quite as flush as they thought he was,
exactly,
and who has some extenuating circumstances that would really destroy his world,
yes,
if they went through with this,
yeah,
yeah.
So, and eventually, that's what brings them down,
right?
So, you know, it this is a movie that has real energy to it. You know, like, we are introduced to Jennifer Lopez's character with this breathtaking pole dance.
And then a breathtaking pose on the roof.
Well yeah, that's coat. After that number.
Like, it's a 1-2 punch of scenes where you're like, okay, you're a goddess. Yes, I guess that's what you are.
She's on the roof with an open fur coat, and she's smoking. And
right.
Destiny comes out to talk to her, and she literally, and you know, takes the Destiny inside of her fur,
envelops
like
her
wing,
in the fur.
You know?
Yeah,
which is a cool moment. Where the movie, where I am less enthusiastic about the film, even though, as it has been pointed out on Twitter, it is a Christmas movie. It has a major Christmas sequence.
Hang on. Just sit tight for just a second. My husband, my handsome husband, my intelligent, brilliant writer husband, has written a book called Have Yourself a Movie Little Christmas. You should buy it because it is comprehensive.
And it's that time of year.
And it's getting to be that time of year. However, his definition of Christmas movie extends to films that have significant Christmas sequences and that aren't all necessarily set entirely at Christmas time. Right. This film has a Christmas sequence that is good and somewhat memorable, but this is not a Christmas movie. Okay, back to you, Alonzo.
I would argue, and again, I didn't start this. Somebody else on Twitter brought it up. And then like three different people like came to me for a ruling on this one.
Oh, so you're Judge Judy now.
I love that's my life now.
Right.
And I say, yes, I will allow it because...
I'll allow it.
Because I think that if there is one significant sequence of a film that is set at Christmas, that's enough. Desk set. You know, is a Christmas movie because it has like a chunk of the film that is set at Christmas.
Has a good chunk of the film that's at Christmas time.
Okay, but this is a major scene and it's an important scene. It's one that you couldn't pull out of the film.
Catherine Hepburn and Spencer Tracy, yes. You guys.
You know, I mean, like, look, I've got Female Trouble in my book, and that has one Christmas scene in it.
Well, Female Trouble's most film, Female Trouble's most famous scene is the Christmas scene. So it counts.
One of them.
Okay.
Anyway.
It's the most famous.
I'm not going to, if I were going to do a future edition of this book, I wouldn't necessarily list Hustlers, but for the people on Twitter who are saying it's a Christmas movie, I'm not going to fight you on it.
Okay. All right.
What keeps me from...
All of you are wrong.
What keeps me from being more into this movie is I feel like it's sort of like with Goldfinch. There's some marrow missing.
A little bit.
You know,
not
like...
Not nearly as much as Goldfinch.
This
works more than it doesn't.
Absolutely, yes.
Okay.
But there are relationships that are not as defined or explained or as enriched as they could have been. There are characters who are introduced that nothing really happens to. Oh, by the way, if you're going to see this movie because Lizzo and Cardi B are in it...
Lizzo has about three scenes, a couple of lines, and then she's gone... And then as soon as the financial crisis hits and all the girls lose their job,
yeah.
Cardi B vanishes from the film.
Yes.
So after about 30 minutes, you don't get any more Cardi B. But while you have her...
Oh, well, yes. But
while you have her, you will understand that she is a movie star in the making.
Somebody needs to tap that.
She's so
talent.
Funny. I thought when I saw her in this film, I thought, oh, you're Judy Holliday. Like, you're exactly that person. You should have a comedy that you can just run with. Yes. And that can be sort of built around
a vehicle.
Built around your unique charisma.
Yes.
I love her.
Another tweet today was that, just FYI, Frank Whaley is in Hustlers more than Lizzo and Cardi B combined.
Yep.
So, yeah, but, you know, you have characters like Destiny's Daughter, like Mercedes Rule as the sort of den mother of the strippers. Yep. And you think, we're going to see more of them? They're going to matter? Nope. They're going to be gone for big chunks of the movie or entirely. You know, there's a whole thing where suddenly Destiny is back at school. Ramona encouraged her to go back to school. That is raised and dropped immediately. Just a lot of stuff like that where it's sort of like, well, why bring it up in the first place?
Yeah.
But, you know, I like this movie more than I don't. I just think it's getting overpraised because it is. I mean, it's worth pointing out. This is a film directed by a woman with women of color leading characters that is aimed at a grown-up audience and that's doing really well.
Yeah.
And that's a good thing. And that
original
is
story.
Yes. It's not IP. It's a reason. All of these things are reason to celebrate.
Yeah.
But let's not lose perspective.
It's a good film.
Yeah.
It accomplishes what it wants to accomplish. I agree with you. It needed, for me, more character work. It's so heavily about Constance Wu and Jennifer Lopez that we lose a lot of the other people. And it's being sold as an
ensemble.
An ensemble. It's not really an ensemble.
Yeah, like Lily Reinhart and
Kiki Palmer is very funny.
They get their own posters, but you don't see much of them.
That she has. Lily Reinhart doesn't have a lot to do except throw up.
Yeah, like that's her running joke.
That's her running gag.
And I still also feel like that even the setup for the Constance Wu Jennifer Lopez relationship happens so quickly.
It's you wonder why and how.
Yeah, because I think, you know, we've been trained from, you know, Showgirls and All About Eve and all these other movies where it's like, so the woman who's at the top of the heap is just going to quickly welcome in this newcomer and neither of them has an agenda at play and they're both totally fine with that. Like,
Do talk a little bit about what they both maybe thought they could get from the relationship. But it's like two sentences.
Yeah.
And it doesn't unfold in a way that makes these characters feel as lived in as they could have been.
Absolutely.
Having said all that, Constance Wu is good.
Yeah.
Cardi B is hilarious. And this is Jennifer Lopez's movie.
Oh, yeah.
This is the perfect film for her. Everything she's great at, she gets to be great at it in this movie.
Yeah.
And I have, for a long time, I've been sort of... I don't want to say rooting for her like she's an underdog, because she's not the underdog on any level. But, like, film has never been the easiest path for her. Out of Sight was wonderful.
Selena.
She's great in Selena. She has moments here and there in other films.
I will do my requisite thing for the director's cut of Jersey Girl that no one has seen that she's great in.
What to Expect When You're Expecting.
Oh my God.
Is a terrible movie.
Yes, but I don't remember her. What did she do in it?
And at the end.
Yes!
At the end, she has this moment.
I forgot about that.
That is so real in a film that otherwise
has, so fake.
Has no real moments at all.
You're right. That is the one genuine moment of that movie. I'd forgotten that.
And you're like, why couldn't this have been all about Jennifer Lopez's character?
Yeah.
Rather than this, you know, Valentine's Day kind of
approach. Gary Marshall hodgepodge of, you know.
And I remember walking out of that movie thinking, I need Jennifer Lopez to be in a movie where she gets to be as good as she can be.
Yeah.
And this is that movie.
Yes.
And now you called me out the other day for speaking a little too casually on KCRW.
I called you out privately.
Here in town. Well, good enough. That's all it takes for me to hold a grudge.
Fine.
we get on KCRW and I say, people are talking about her getting an Oscar nomination for this. And I said, and why not? She should get an Oscar nomination for this. And you came to me after and said, look at you talking about the Academy Awards.
Okay, I brought it up because the headline on the KCRW website was, critic says Jennifer Lopez should win Oscar for Hustlers.
That is not what I said.
I'm like, great. That's how we're being described now.
Okay, well, A, I didn't write that headline. B, I didn't say that at all. I didn't say she should win an Oscar.
Right.
I said she could get an Academy Award nomination and she deserves one as much as anyone else deserves an Academy Award nomination for a good performance at this time of year, which is what this time of year is about.
Well, true.
And there have been way worse performances that have gotten Academy Award nominations.
Oh, absolutely.
That have even won
yes.
the award.
No.
And so why not?
I have gotten very gun. This is where hopping topics here. I've gotten very gun shy about ever talking about this stuff because there are far too many people who aren't really critics who like that's their only way of describing something as being good as being Oscar worthy.
I know.
And Oscar buzz and Oscar, Oscar,
and
Oscar.
Generally, I am not the person who talks about the Academy Awards, but other people have been talking about that this week.
Yeah, absolutely.
And I wanted
I agree with
A,
you
to get a word in on the radio station. And so I thought, well, I'm going to go with what the people are talking about this week. You know me, man of the people.
Mr. Vox Populi.
I'm a populist person. All about that. No, and so I just like, look, you know what would be cool? Yeah, if Jennifer Lopez got an Academy Award nomination. That would get up the nose of plenty of people.
Mm.
I'd like it.
Yeah. Okay, sure. I think she's got the Golden Globe locked.
Oh, she's getting the Golden Globe.
Yeah.
She's going to win that Golden Globe.
No question.
And then when she doesn't, I'll just say, look, I don't care. Because no one cares about the Golden Globes in reality.
Yeah. Where are the awards for Charlize Theron and Longshot, I ask you?
That's a good question. I don't know the answer.
That movie wasn't a hit. No one's going to remember
it. No one's going to remember it. She's hilarious.
And it's comedy and they ignore that. So.
Right.
Yeah.
So.
Letters.
Letters?
No.
What are you talking about?
I don't know. Okay, I guess I don't know.
We need to talk about Adam.
Yes.
Oh, you guys, this movie called Adam.
Which I still haven't seen.
Well, you can wait. You can wait till it hits streaming or DVD. And it will come very soon to that. Adam is an independent queer film. And it is based on a novel by Ariel Schrag,
right.
who also adapted the book for this film.
Incidentally, we did show this at Outfest. They programmed it right after Sundance.
Yes.
So like, it was already locked in the schedule by the time I started.
Are you trying to not take any responsibility for this programming?
No, I'm trying to say, like, if people are wondering, wait, how has Alonzo not seen it? It was at Outfest. Like,
yes.
I didn't see
they
it.
They locked it before you started.
Yeah, it was already
seasonal employment.
And I kept meaning to get around to it, but I just
Alonzo's a seasonal employee of Outfest. He wraps the gifts.
Oh.
Directed by Reese Ernst.
Yes.
And this is the story of a young teenage cisgender heterosexual boy,
mm-hmm.
about 16 years old, and he has a lesbian older sister played by Margaret Qualley. Adam is played by, what is his name, Nicholas Alexander. He's been in a lot of stuff, but I've never seen him until now. His older sister is a lesbian, and he goes to New York City to spend the summer with her in the year 2006.
Yes. Which is a period.
Which is a meaningful time in terms of what happens in this film and how people speak to each other. He falls in with her group of friends, all of whom are queer, and many of whom are trans or
non-binary.
Or non-binary, or in some other way, gender non-conforming.
Sure.
A variety of presentations of gender. So he quickly kind of becomes a part of that world with his sister. And he meets a young girl played by Bobby Salvor Menuez. In real life, she's a model and an artist, and she does all kinds of stuff. I read several articles about her before watching the film. I'd never heard of her before. I want to do a little research on the cast. She is transgender.
Ah.
And maybe her pronoun is they. Don't quote me on that because I don't remember what I read regarding that. He falls in love with her. She plays a teenage lesbian. Well, I'm sorry, not a teenage lesbian. She plays a lesbian who's about 20.
Mm-hmm. College.
And who is actually a famous teen lesbian because she, in the film, her storyline is that when she was in high school, she lobbied her school district to be allowed to take her girlfriend to the prom.
Ah.
And so she became sort of a national spokesperson for queer kids going to prom and having their rights, you know, to go as couples. She mistakes Adam for a trans boy. And he lies about his age, says he's 19, 18, however old. And when she mistakes him for being trans, he does not
correct her.
And this film becomes the story of a young heterosexual cisgender boy manipulating a community to get what he wants.
Mm.
He does so with a sort of veil of innocence in that he feels like he's gotten himself in too deep and he doesn't know how to get out. And he feels like he has to go through with the lie because he's falling in love with her. And he does what he does and it's bad, but his character does so without malice.
Gotcha.
Which doesn't make it good.
No.
It makes it a terrible thing that he does. But in the world of this film, he is sort of hapless.
Right.
No one knows what's going on. No one understands what he's doing. He somehow manages to slip in and out of conversations with people.
The sister doesn't even know?
The sister doesn't even know that's what he's doing. His trans male, best friend doesn't know what's happening. And then it all comes to a head and he has to confess.
Right.
I'm now going to spoil this movie just in case you don't want to know. I think it becomes important.
You can't talk about it without.
I can't talk about what's wrong with this film without telling you what happens.
Gotcha.
He confesses. And she says, I knew. And you're sitting in the audience going, I'm sorry, what? Because they have sex in the film. And he straps down his own genitalia and uses a prosthetic.
Mm-hmm.
One of those, the strap-on things,
right?
And when this happens, you're like, oh my God, oh my God, oh my God, what? This character is doing a very bad thing right now. He's immediately let off the hook.
Oh, yeah.
She says, I knew. I'm like, when did you know? How come the movie didn't let us know that you knew?
Yeah.
Why are we all being gotcha'd right now? You know? And then, bit by bit, people learn what's going on. And, but the person who has to be told who's going to be take this, I guess, the hardest, even though he wasn't the one that was deceived sexually, is his trans male best friend.
Mm-hmm.
And when he tells the friend...
Does the trans male best friend also think that he is trans?
No. Okay. The trans male best friend knows that he's not.
I see.
But doesn't learn that he's been deceiving...
Right, yes.
...the lesbian girl.
Until later.
Until later. And he's the second person to be told. Mm-hmm. And he gets up and is like, nope. That's horrible what you have done. We're not friends. Goodbye. Live with it. And 5 minutes later, he forgives him.
Ooh.
And I'm like, You know what? Movie. Hey, movie. There's such a thing as stakes.
Yes.
Your movie needs stakes. If you want to take a character doing something reprehensible and show us that character doing something reprehensible, that's a legitimate use of storytelling. If you then want your film to have any kind of weight, there has to be a lasting consequence of some sort. And in this film, there is no lasting consequence, and nothing weighs anything, and nothing matters. And so you're sitting in the film, you're watching it thinking, that matters, oh my God, that really matters. Yeah.
And then they graph the last 10 minutes of Tootsie onto it.
And then, yeah, and then the last bit, everyone's like, you know, we all forgive you, and it's okay, and you were young, and you didn't know, and that's one of the things the film being set in 2006 is also sort of about. I assume the novel is also set in 2006. I don't know. I haven't read the novel. I know the novel was very controversial among trans readers.
As has been the film.
And the film has been... Woo! The film
has
gotten all kinds of deserved heat.
And Rhys Ernst, it should be pointed out, is a trans filmmaker.
Rhys Ernst is a trans filmmaker. I don't know what he was thinking. And I'm not here to tell trans people what to do with their lives at all. But I am here to tell you that this is a terrible movie, not because of its content, but because... A, like I just said, the dramatic stakes are non-existent.
Yeah. He's not going to commit to them.
If you aimed to have a film with a moral, your moral is do whatever you want, and eventually people will let you off the hook for it, which is bizarre. And it is just sort of inert overall. It's a cheap, cheap, cheap indie movie. The writing is bad. There's no real comedy, even though it's meant to be a comedy of sorts. The acting's not good.
How are Margaret Qualley and MJ Rodriguez?
Margaret Qualley is the lone sort of spark of life in this movie. You got a lot of newcomers in this movie who are not being directed to good performances. And MJ Rodriguez has one scene where she reads a poem. And, you know, she's great. Listen. Trans listeners, have you seen this movie? Please
tell us.
Tell us what you think about this film, because it's bad for two reasons for me. For me, it's bad because its message is all weird and screwed up. And it's just bad filmmaking as well. Now, I would like to direct your attention to a great article on Mubi, M-U-B-I, by a trans film critic, a person named Caden Mark Gardner.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I we're Twitter friends.
The name of the article is Adam, or What Are the Responsibilities of a Trans Film Critic? And it's an extensive, it's a long read, but really worth reading. In it, he argues, this film has a right to exist. And it is a film that also needs to be discussed for what it tries to do, what it gets wrong, for the weight of a film like this. It's trans narratives are in this place now where every single one of them feels urgent and important. And if the film is bad, then it seems like a more crushing disappointment. It's kind of like how films about gay men and lesbians 25 years ago felt like, we need this, we really need this, and we need it to be good right now.
Yeah, there's an urgency for that, but then and there's also there aren't a ton of them.
Correct.
So we have to nail it, you know.
Yeah. And this is just this film is a mess, which is very disappointing.
It is too bad. Because I've seen some of Rhys's shorts at Outfest, and I knew he worked on Transparent.
Yeah.
I had hopes for this.
I haven't read any interviews with Rhys Ernst. in which maybe there are some explanations for what this film is trying to be. I know it's getting some praise from people, but I think it's bad filmmaking, and I think that it is a movie that, if I were trans, I would say, "Hey, what's like? Are we gonna say that because it happens in 2006 that that's a long enough time ago that this sort of thing would happen and we would have all wanted to forgive?" You know,
I don't know.
I'm really, really looking forward to hearing from people tell me their thoughts on this one.
Yeah, I've seen a lot of rancor from people who haven't seen the film. I would like to hear the rancor of people who have seen
it. I don't have rancor. I just have sort of disappointment and I'm...
Befuddlement?
I'm befuddled, yes. Like, what do you... You could have had one person forgive him and another person say, no.
Yeah.
No, you're not forgiven. Live with it.
Yeah.
And that would have... Remember the ending of The Last American Virgin?
Ooh.
Remember the unhappy ending of Last American Virgin?
Yes, yes, yes.
How about we get a little of that?
Yeah.
What about a little bit of unhappiness? Learn your lesson.
Yeah.
Because, learn your lesson.
Unhappiness and because go you be did different. A bad thing.
You did a bad thing. You learned your lesson. Go be different.
Last American Virgin didn't do anything wrong, but, you know, it is a bummer.
It's a bummer.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I'll take a little bit of a bummer, you know? If the girlfriend wants to forgive him, fine. Fine. If the other person would just have said, no.
Oh, hell no.
No, that's just life. Some people are not going to forgive you.
Right.
And that is real life.
Sure.
You can say you're sorry all day, and some people are like, yeah, no. So, anyway. Adam. Maybe see it. Tell me what you think about it. That's all. Yeah, we got letters.
Okay. These are letters from our summer Super Splash Spectacular, where we made episodes of our usually Patreon-only shows, like LKTV, a podcast of the television, and Linoleum Knife and Fork, a food podcast hosted by two film critics, and Linoleum Nights, where we talk about topics, available to the...
Current events.
Sure. Yeah. We made all those...
And really anything we feel like talking about.
We made episodes of all those shows available to the general public. But usually, if you want to hear those shows, you've got to subscribe to our Patreon at patreon.com/linoleumknife.
Keep talking about it while I scroll down and find these letters.
We've got, like I said, those three shows for additional content for folks. Yeah. We also have daily recommendations. We have monthly club meetings.
Daily cultural recommendations. Yes. We call it LKRX.
Yes.
These... keep going.
We thank you for butting in.
We
have a monthly club meeting where we get together and watch a Netflix movie together and talk about it online in a Google Hangout. There's, you know, shirts and mugs and Christmas ornaments and enamel pins and other Linoleum Knife swag. Linoleum Knife. Sorry. Patreon.com/linoleumknife. We think it'll be worth your while.
Did you say Patreon subscriptions begin at $1?
They begin at $1 a month. $1 a month. Oh, we have a thing called Private Knife where we'll do a bespoke, custom made 20-minute podcast for you on the topic of your choice.
Yeah.
So if you are already a Patreon member, thank you. You rock. And if you aren't, maybe think about being one.
You rock. You rock.
You rock. You rock, you stone, you worse than senseless thing.
It's just funny when people say you rock.
So it's just a thing.
It's like a very 80s thing to say.
Fine. Yeah. You're the bee's knees. You're the cat's pajamas.
Thank you. Yeah. That's the kind of...
23 Skidoo.
That's the kind of thing I like to hear. this is a letter from Daniel about LKTV.
Okay.
I have no idea what this letter is about. It says, Matt Wilkus and Dan Vincent have a comedy channel on YouTube called Matt and Dan that is pretty funny. I don't know who these people are. What were we talking about?
Matt Wilkus made this comment happen? He's the guy who is or was in a relationship with Gus Kenworthy.
Okay.
And I forget how all of this came up now, but it did come up.
The minute we finish recording a podcast, I forget what we talked about.
It flies right out of my idea. We talked about Matthew Wilkus for some reason, and I can't remember why now.
This is another LKTV letter. I hope it's something I understand and remember. Clint says, I binged Pose without commercials before Disney shut down FX Plus. It is a show I find equally both bad and terrific, and I cannot wait for season 3. Until then, I have a few questions for you both. Angel and Poppy are heading to Berlin for a modeling job less than 12 hours. Considering this, do you think the premiere of season 3 will deal with the hardship of the trans community when they have to endure travel documents assigned to their incorrect gender? Who knows?
Could be.
We'll find out in season 3, won't we? Number 2, Electra described the ballroom council and the judging panel as a boys' club, with a scene showing her being judged by a panel of men, which, based on the costumes, took place in the early 1980s. Okay, well, kind of. I found this plotline a bit confusing because throughout the season there have been male and female judges. Well, that we...
Right, but the council, the dudes who actually run the whole thing, right, is all male.
Yeah. It felt like a contrived way to get Pray Tell up in drags. Maybe. Thoughts? Lastly, I have to report that Matt Wilkes and Gus Cranworthy are no longer a couple as of July of 2019.
Bummer.
I don't really have thoughts about this because I just let the show wash over me.
Yeah, I mean, at the end of the day,
it is a
Ryan Murphy production, so it's probably best not to
sometimes
ask too
everything
many questions.
Doesn't always make sense
exactly
when Ryan Murphy decides to change things on a whim. Joe comments on Linoleum Nights. He says, I've been shouting Demolition Man and Death Becomes Her in my car for a second.
Well, we were,
do you remember what
we
that's
were,
about?
We were playing the game Cinephile, the new card game.
Oh, that is what we did on Linoleum Nights. We played the game Cinephile.
And Demolition Man is a Sandra Bullock movie.
Yes.
And I'm not sure who the person was that he was yelling Death Becomes Her over. Oh, Bruce Willis, maybe? I think Bruce Willis.
Maybe.
Yeah, if you ever played Cinephile, it's a lot of fun. And it is now available. It just came out at the end of August.
This is another Linoleum Nights letter from Andrew. He says, I agree with your analysis regarding all of these studios doing their own streaming services. It's going to be a pain for a couple of years, but I bet the streaming services will tank and eventually the studios will go back to Netflix or Hulu. Nobody's going to pay for all these different services.
Yeah, no, I just discovered that there's an IFC streaming thing and a Magnolia streaming platform. It's like, you know... Just saying, Ovid is carrying a lot of different distributors, you know, all under one umbrella.
Yes, they are.
But if every different little studio is going to go out on their own thing, it's like that's a lot of subscriptions.
There's one more Linoleum Nights comment from James.
Uh huh.
And I know what this was about because I was asking you what was the brand of popsicle that you were eating right before we went on the mic.
Mm-hmm.
You said it was Outshine.
Yes.
Outshined was the name of a Soundgarden song.
Oh.
I said, it's the favorite popsicle of Soundgarden.
Oh.
And you were like, I don't even know what that is.
Yeah.
But James says, I appreciated and laughed at the Soundgarden joke. Thank you. I deserve it.
Good for you. Good for everyone who gets that joke.
We're done. Yeah.
All right. Hey, thanks for listening. Check out our friends on the internet. Go to ChristyLemire.com. Bibbs and Whitney have launched a network now. The critically acclaimed network is where most of their shows are going to live. I can't keep up. Go to their Patreon page. I think it's Critic Acclaim, and that'll tell you everything you need to know. I think they're still doing some stuff over at Schmoes Now, and you should, of course, check out the Schmoes while you're there. Listen to Dennis Anyone with Dennis Hensley, Sewers of Paris, the Comics Canon, Deck the Hallmark, All Things Cozy, Bad Guys of the Movies, the Criterion Cast, and Secretly Timid. You can subscribe to this show for free at Apple Podcasts. Leave us a beautiful 5-star review. We will read it on the air. You can also leave us positive feedback in all the places that we stream, like Stitcher and Spotify and CastBox and Podbean and Google Play and TheLounge.com. Follow us at LinoleumCast on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook. And drop us a line at LinoleumPodcast@gmail.com with questions or comments. Long episode, so we'll skip doing the DVD pick this week, but we'll have that and much more stuff for you next week. So until then,
goodbye.